CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Hussain. I'll be here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, in Montreal, ravers rally to save nightlife group Montreal 2424.
After 3 years of working with them, they decided that probably they knew better now than we do, and that they did not need us anymore. So they decided to cut our funding. So it's basically a debt that they're wishing us.
Out in BC, the former Green Party deputy leader was found guilty of contempt of court.
Her intention had nothing to do with that. Her intention had to do with abiding by her own laws and her own obligations as a Kwakwaka'wakw land guardian.
Hundreds of Sackville area properties see assessment spikes of over 25%. Citizens wonder how to face the tax hikes that go with it.
My house has gone up $110,200 in 1 year. I haven't so much as planted a tree on my property. And in the last 6 years, it has gone up almost $300,000.
And to Nova Scotia, where city officials gamble to support people experiencing homelessness, taking on the provincial government's responsibility, and it pays off.
There's just been a buy-in unlike anywhere else I've ever been, that everyone wants to be a part of it, and everyone wants to support this equity-deserving population in a way that is just very unique.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI and listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks so much for keeping us company. Former Green Party of Canada Deputy Leader Angela Davidson was convicted of 7 counts of criminal contempt of court in a Nanaimo courtroom on January 18. This for repeatedly breaking an injunction against blocking logging operations in the area of the Fairy Creek watershed on West Vancouver Island. Davidson, also known as Rainbow Eyes, was convicted for participation in an anti-logging blockade on West Vancouver Island in 2021 and 2022. Davidson, who also was the Green Party's Indigenous Affairs critic, is a Kwakwaka'wakw person and a member of the Danukda First Nation. She argued that her actions were supported by her position as a Kwakwaka'wakw land guardian. More with Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
Davidson locked herself to a log and roll gate with a bicycle lock around her neck and one arm inside a pipe, where she was chained to another protester within the injunction zone in May 2021. When she refused to leave, an RCMP officer gave her a written copy of the injunction granted to forestry company T.O. Cedar banning the blocking of the road before arresting her. A month later, Davidson climbed on top of a grader singing and drumming, preventing forestry workers from using it as other protesters blocked his path. Davidson was read the injunction order and arrested again. Davidson's lawyer, Ben Isaac, says Davidson was acting to prevent the forestry workers from injuring other protesters.
Her position is that a T.O. Cedar contractor was driving a bulldozer unsafely in a way that was threatening the safety of some individuals who were gathered near the gate. And so in order to protect the people near the gate, she got onto the bulldozer so the operator couldn't threaten the safety of the individuals gathered near the gate.
Isaac says the crux of the case was if Davidson had what was known as a guilty mind, when she violated the injunction and her bail conditions.
Essentially, whether she intended or was willful or reckless as to whether her conduct would bring the court's reputation into disrepute or would lower the reputation of the court. And so our argument is that her intention had nothing to do with that. Her intention had to do with abiding by her own laws and her own obligations as a Kwakwaka'wakw land guardian.
Davidson, who's also the Green Party's Indigenous Affairs critic, is a Kwakwaka'wakw person and a member of the Danukda First Nation. She argued her actions were supported by her position as a land guardian in accordance with Kwakwaka'wakw customs and traditions. In his judgment, Chief Justice Hinkson wrote that while the evidence demonstrates that Ms. Davidson was invited onto the territory of the Panashta First Nation, nothing before me demonstrates this invitation gave her some sort of license to pursue the interests she had as a land guardian in her own First Nation. I find Ms. Davidson's role as a land guardian did not entitle her, let alone require her, to enter the territory of another First Nation to impose her priorities in such territories. In two of the following charges, Davidson brought food to the protest camps near Fairy Creek, and twice in January 2022, she entered the injunction zone to help search for Kevin Bear Henry, who had gone missing in the area in November. According to Isaac, Davidson argued the search for Henry was a necessity.
Particularly the search party allegations, we argued that at most her conduct was de minimis and was a trivial or trifling infraction. and that she shouldn't be convicted on that basis.
Chief Justice Hinkson wrote that he did not believe Davidson entered the injunction area to search for Henry, and instead said that her purpose on those days was to continue her opposition to old-growth logging by Teal Cedar. Isaac says while Davidson was convicted, it was important to put the question of Indigenous law before the court, and the judge's ruling may open possible defenses for Indigenous people acting on their own land.
The judge's findings are quite specific to her. So, for example, she's from Kwakwaka'wakw territory, not from the Tsleil-Waututh, where the protests were occurring. So there's elements of the written decision that leave the door open for land offenders, particularly in their own territory.
A Gladue report is now being prepared for sentencing, which is expected to happen sometime this spring. This is Mick Sweetman.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Sackville resident Sabin Dietze says that she was shocked when she took a look at her property assessment notice sent by Service New Brunswick. She was surprised to see that her home, an older house well outside of town, is now worth a whopping 28% more than it was last year. Hundreds of Sackville properties were also hit by the same hikes in 2024, amounts that will surely be reflected in future tax bills. Jamie Smith has been a realtor in Sackville for the past 14 years. He says housing sales over the course of the pandemic have increased by over 80%. Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick, checks in with Smith about the source of the spikes, the province's hot pandemic housing market, and also with some homeowners who are facing the shock. They share their concerns about the impact on the wider community, as well as their experiences with appealing those assessments with Service New Brunswick.
Property owners in New Brunswick have started receiving their updated property assessments in the mail, and plenty of Chanchamar residents are getting a shock. Hundreds of properties are seeing increases in their assessments of 28 to 29% over the previous year, and many are reporting that the increase has come without any work done to their properties.
My house has gone up $110,200 in 1 year. I haven't so much as planted a tree on my property. And in the last 6 years, it has gone up almost $300,000.
Alana Best bought her house on Charlotte Street in 2018 and has been fighting off large assessment increases since then. This year, she's looking at a 17.5% hike, which could drive her taxes to around $800 per month. Best's house is somewhat unique in Sackville, a large home with some luxury amenities and market prices all over the map since it was first sold in 2014. She bought the house low after a previous owner had defaulted on the mortgage. And in her original appeal to Service New Brunswick over massive assessment increases, she included letters from realtors attesting to the actual market value of the property. Best was able to get Service New Brunswick to reduce their first assessment hike, but since then, she has been submitting requests for review and getting refused. Last year, she sat out the request for review process due to the emotional toll it takes.
I was so emotionally upset over it that I couldn't go sit in a room with them again and have the discussions that we had had, because the year prior, I was crying my eyes out.
This year, Best expects to submit a request for review for her 17.5% hike. Service New Brunswick says that last year they received nearly 9,000 requests for review. That's a new high, up from roughly 5,000 to 6,000 requests in 2020 and 2021, before they started adjusting assessments to match New Brunswick's surging housing market. And while the number of review requests has gone up, the chances of success have gone down. Last year, about one-fifth of reviews resulted in a lower assessment. Just 2 years previous, in 2021, nearly half saw a reduction. Service New Brunswick spokesperson Jennifer Vianos says that no requests for review have resulted in higher assessments in recent years, and property owners have 30 days from the date on their assessment to file a request for review. High Marsh Road resident Sabina Dietz is not sure if she will file a review, but she will be calling Service New Brunswick for an explanation of the 28% hike in her assessment.
We have an old house, so it's from the 1800s. And there's nothing that's happened over the last couple of years to the house, except sort of internal renovations and things. So you can't really from the outside see, there's no change to the house essentially. And I know there's one house that has been built on Church Street since then, since last year. So there's one house that's been added. Seeing a $46,000 increase to the value of our house, which is in our case quite a lot. Our house was assessed, I think, at 167 last year, and now it's over 213 or something. That's a gigantic jump for an old place, that I was really surprised.
Dietz says she almost didn't look at her assessment notice since it's not an actual tax bill, but more a warning sign of things to come. But she's encouraging people to make sure they open the envelope from Service New Brunswick.
I think people need to be aware and should look at their assessments and then think about, well, what does it mean for my pocketbook?
Realtor Jamie Smith has been working in real estate in town for 14 years. He says the assessment spike is a sign that Service New Brunswick is playing catch up with spikes in the housing market that took place during the pandemic. Smith says he considers pre- and post-COVID to represent two different markets.
So Sackville, basically over the last 5 years, average sale price has gone up 81%, from the mid-160s to the mid-290s. Tangipahoa area actually went up even higher, so that includes Dorchester, obviously, and kind of the outside areas. Average sale price, $287,000, so just under 87% average increase over 5 years. Basically, all of that increase happened from 2019 to 2022 and then leveled off for 2023. In terms of assessments, obviously, we're seeing the assessments catching up to market value, which is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of people.
And the upward adjustment in assessment is not exactly evenly applied. Across the municipality, 2024 assessments have gone up 9.2%, according to numbers released by the province in October. But buried in that average are hundreds of properties facing 20 to 30% hikes. Over on Wellington, Judith Weiss's assessment has gone up 50% over the past 2 years. She owns her own home and two neighboring properties, which she rents. She says she won't be raising rents to absorb the higher taxes, but she's not confident most landlords will be able to do the same.
And I happen to be in a position to absorb it for the time being. But then I think of other property owners who are not in my position, and most of whom are in it for the income. So their net income will be reduced. So they will either resort to rent evictions to raise rents up to 30% or more, or they will neglect necessary maintenance to protect some margin of profit. And it's only logical that this drastic increase will result in worsening housing conditions all around.
Weiss is concerned about the broader effect of the sharp rise in assessments.
I'm looking at a street like mine. There are two houses rented to students, three houses whose owners are seniors on fixed incomes, three houses owned by single parents or a single wage earner for a family of four. If the property assessments on even two of these houses are allowed to stand because of their supposed market value, that will in turn justify increases for all the other houses based on that same false premise.
Sabina Dietz shares a similar concern.
We're okay personally with that increase. So I'm not worried about it for me. But what it means for the community and for people who can't afford this kind of increase and looking forward at increases in a community where we've got so many older homes and older places, where we know we already have challenges with food security, with challenges around housing, all of these, low-income housing, housing opportunities, affordable housing opportunities. We have already problems and challenges around that. And so you throw that on top of that, these things are all connected. And so my assessment increase is totally connected to what else happens in Tantramar and where it happens and how people are impacted to it. So, of course, I worry about it.
That's High Marsh Road resident Sabina Dietz. Many property owners will have some protection from this year's high assessments. New Brunswick's Spike Protection Program limits tax increases on those with assessments growing by more than 10%. Dietz points out that 10% is still a significant hike, and those with nearly 30% hikes can expect to see those 10% increases every year until their assessments catch up. In neighboring Nova Scotia, which has a longer history with wild housing markets in some areas of the province has a capped assessment program which limits assessment increases to the Consumer Price Index. This year, the Nova Scotia program ensures assessment values won't grow by more than 3.2% unless there's been work on the property or it has changed hands.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
And while Sackville residents are fighting property tax hikes, things are looking up for Community Hub, an emergency shelter with regular meals and 6 supportive housing units, is set to open in Amherst, Nova Scotia, early next month. It was a project that was discussed for years, but made reality soon after the town's council ponied up $100,000 to create a new position. The position of Executive Director of the Cumberland Homelessness and Housing Support Association was created with funds out of the municipal budget. The person who holds that position was tasked with making the project a reality. Ashley Legere is that person. After languishing for years, the project and build are now fully funded with the money kicked in from both the province and the federal government. Tori Weldon in Sackville, New Brunswick.
This is the studio.
Ashley Legere is the proud leader of this tour. She points to a nearby building.
Like the green roof over there,
yeah.
That's where we operate our daytime location. And then the church that's right there is where we operate the nighttime location.
The Cumberland Homelessness and Housing Support Association is currently running its services out of 2 different locations in downtown Amherst. Ashley Legere is the group's executive director.
They're not very far apart. I mean, you can see one from the other, yeah. But it's moving people out at 8 o'clock in the morning in the freezing cold or snow to go to another place is inhumane.
But things are about to change. This brand new building is almost done. The plan is for it to be a lot of things to, unfortunately, a lot of people. Located at 10 Prince Arthur Street, this construction will be an emergency shelter, supportive housing, a place for people in need of food, and generally a place to access help and services as they arise.
What kind of need is there? So we did a service-based count, and I say we, the town and the YMCA of Amherst did a service-based count back in 2021, I believe, and there were 48 individuals who identified as sleeping rough or precariously housed. From January of 2023 until May of 2023, we ran an overnight space at the Crossroads Church, and we saw 39 unique individuals access the space, on average between 6 and 12 per night. And that's what we're seeing now.
This is just Amherst?
This is just Amherst. Yeah, we do see people coming in for more supports and food security reasons mm-hmm. during the day. So we house between 6 and 12 individuals in our overnight shelter on average, but we are serving upwards of 50 meals to a day to individuals who are housed. Yes, so since May, we have served over 10,000 meals.
In just Amherst alone?
In just Amherst. Well, the only place that is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're also the only place that serves meals that many times. So we serve 3 meals a day. Breakfast is continental. Lunch and supper usually is a bagged lunch that you can come in and get and leave if you'd like. There's no barriers to these services. So I'm not asking you if you're housed. I'm not asking you what your income is. If you feel like you need to come in for a meal, then you should be able to come in for a meal.
What kind of services do people have, like if they come here, what do they have access to in order to take the next step to not need it anymore?
So we will work with the YMCA outreach team directly. We will have case management. So we'll be working with people to support them in their needs based on what their needs are. Right now we have access to mental health and addictions. They come in once a week in the afternoons. We have public health comes in and does vaccinations. We're working with VON moving forward with the YDC currently, so the Youth Development Center. We're all really connected. We have this coordinated access. We meet regularly and discuss what we're doing here. Any support that you could think of has offered and committed to be here. There's just been a buy-in unlike anywhere else I've ever been, that everyone wants to be a part of it, and everyone wants to support this equity deserving population in a way that is just very unique.
And there are a lot of unique things about this project, as Legere mentioned. Community groups, nonprofits, and many citizens of Amherst are in support of what's happening. It's a level of collaboration that's hard to achieve. But another standout feature is the municipality's approach. Housing is a provincial responsibility, so many municipalities try to figure out ways to get the province and the federal government to help to address their issues. What Amherst did differently is it took a carefully thought out leap of faith. the town committed to pay the salary of the newly created executive director position, the one Ashley Legere fills. And then it tasked her with getting 10 Prince Arthur built.
Housing is an all-hands-on-deck problem. People living in poverty and living with homelessness and going, you know, out in minus 20 temperatures in the wintertime, not having a place to shelter, is an everybody problem.
Leon Landry is a Town of Amherst councillor. He's a member and chair of the Poverty Reduction Advisory Committee, which is an Amherst Council committee. He's also a member of the Cumberland Homelessness and Housing Support Association. He knows how hard volunteers at nonprofits were working to combat homelessness. But doing good off the side of a desk is hard, and the demand was outgrowing the resources.
Ultimately, we understood that in order for these not-for-profits to obtain monies from the provincial government in order to do the things that they wanted to do, aside from volunteer work, it would be the best use of our funds to enable them to do that. So we've tried to leverage small amounts of municipal funds to enable not-for-profits to access funding from other levels of government.
Was there any fear that this would take some of the responsibility away from the provincial government, or that you'd be sort of paying for things that other places aren't, or, you know, just that fear of sort of getting involved and then being stuck with it?
Yes, there was that, you know, that criticism or that skepticism came up in the conversations, you know, well, you know, this is the provincial responsibility. You know, if we take it on or we start to contribute financially, are these roles going to be downloaded to us? And I think the proof is in the pudding. I mean, the Department of Community Services flat out said, we would not have funded you had this executive director position not been created. Mm-hmm. So it's the opposite. We're accessing funds that probably would not have been available to this organization of volunteers had we not contributed. You know, it adds that level of, I'm going to call it risk aversion, that makes provincial governments feel like, okay, the community as an organization, the municipal organization feels confident enough in this group of folks to give them $100,000, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's not a small amount of money when you're talking about a municipal budget. Because of that, they proceeded to, you know, give them capital costs and operational costs. And, you know, Ashley's done a great job of raising funding all over the place, to the point where, you know, the project is now capitalized and paid for, which is pretty exciting. And we're looking at the doors being open imminently.
It's a great start, according to Leon Landry.
But it's really actually only going to work if all of the communities across the country and even beyond that buy into that type of behavior, you know, because, you know, it's all one Marcus.
And Ashley Legere says she hopes to talk about this project with Tantramar Town Council soon.
This is a one bedroom.
Okay.
And then the side is, I'll take you through the whole place, but this is one.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sessang.
Ravers gathered in Montreal's Old Port next to the St. Lawrence River in support of Montreal 2424, an organization whose funding was cut by the City of Montreal last week. For the past 3 years, Montreal 2424 has worked with the city as a local hub for research, engagement, and events about Montreal's nightlife. But the future of that work may now be up in the air. Last week, the city declined to renew that funding after announcing their new nightlife plan for Montreal's Quartier Latin, according to Montreal 2424. On a snowy night in the Old Port of Montreal, supporters of the organization DJed and danced outside of Monday's city council session. Inside, Mayor Valérie Plante chose not to answer questions about our priorities in the sector, with Executive Committee President Luc Rabouin taking the floor for her instead. More with Jules Bugiel in Montreal.
Bright lights, loud music, warm clothes. The scene in the Old Port on Monday night had all the makings of a good rave. But the partiers were gathered outside the Lucien Saulnier building with another purpose, to show their support for a nightlife group whose budget was cut by the city councillors inside.
Oh, I got an email, a two-line email, saying that they could not accept our funding application because the nightlife policy was going in public consultation at the Economical the Commission of the Economical Development, and they were waiting for the results of the commission to set the priorities for the city. So that means that
by the time that's all finished, the city will have moved on to funding for 2025, says Mathieu Goldin. Goldin is the general director of Montreal 2424, a local hub for research engagement and events about Montreal's nightlife. It's an organization whose very existence is in danger unless the city changes course.
Tonight is a demonstration because the city decided to cut our funding. After 3 years of working with them, they decided that probably they knew better now than we do, and that they did not need us anymore. So they decided to cut our funding, and that means for us the cancellation of the Night Summit, the laying off of all our employees, and we have to stop the activities of the Night Council too. So it's basically a death that they're wishing us.
That decision comes hot on the heels of the city's new nightlife strategy, which would see the Quartier Latin become a 24-hour zone. Goldin says the city's focused on extending alcohol sales when the issues facing nightlife are much larger.
Of course, it's a step back. I think right now the only thing the city thinks that they need to do is to open venues, bars later than 3 a.m., maybe in the Latin Quarter, and that's about it. That's their old vision. That the vision is selling booze after three, and that's it. They don't seem to recognize the depth of the problems when it comes to zoning, to noise bylaws, to lack of affordability of nightlife for youth. So it's something that we need to do to act upon, and act upon it fast, because we're slowly becoming a Toronto that speaks French. So who's going to want to come here?
Christian Bonneau was one of those who came out on Monday to support Montreal 2424. He said the city's policy lacks vision.
Nightlife is important, so they're like, okay, we'll give a shot. So Montreal 24, they did a full mandate. Now the city is like, okay, we're going to come out with a policy. And the policy they came up with is what the old administration came up with. Oh, we're going to do Le Quartier Latin as... But if you go physically in the space, there's no real physical space. There's no building for that. So you're like, okay, how it's going to happen?
He said that any money the city spends on groups like Montreal 2424 pays dividends down the road in the strength of its nightlife and festival scene.
There should be really like more actor involved. You know, it's not just like the nightlife industry or the bar industry. No, it's all the industries, you know. I mean, if we want that as a culture to live and as an industry to flourish, because like I said at the beginning, you know, it does represent a lot of money. You know, it's millions of dollars every year. Jazz is part of that. Francophonie is part of that. You know, Oceaga is part of that. Picnic Electronic, Igloo Fest, like all those, you know, Mad Festival, Fashion and Design, all those art things. I mean, it drives the city. Montreal is known as a festival city. Like it's just a logic thing. But, like, you need people to organize, like...
Inside the Lucien Saulnier building, Mayor Valérie Plante was asked about her commitment to the sector. Executive Committee President Luc Rabouin countered.
On finance des projets, on finance pas des organismes.
We finance projects, we don't finance organizations, he said, adding...
Il y a eu plusieurs séances de travail pour qu'on arrive.
There were several working sessions so that we could develop a nightlife policy that seems to us interesting and ambitious, and that certainly aims to address many of your concerns. What does it take? It takes consultations in which stakeholders will be able to speak, as well as the entire Montreal population. All the organizations can give their opinion on what is essential and relevant in the policy, what is less so, but above all, what are the priority actions that we need to take in the short term, where we should start. The mayor's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Only time will tell how those consultations will go if the city is at odds with its nightlife sector. And the future of Montreal 2424 remains up in the air. I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening.
And thank you for bringing this story to us, Jules. concludes this episode of Viewpoints, brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Thanks to our journalists this week, Jules Bugiel, Mick Sweetman, Tori Weldon, welcome, and Erica Butler. Our national editors were Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Comments, ideas, suggestions, please write at radio@frequencynews.ca. That's radio@frequencynews.ca. Also, catch all our stories at frequencynews.ca. Please stay tuned to what follows. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.